Lisa, I just thought I should check, see if you can hear me.
Loud and clear.
Okay, I'm sorry I can't be there with you guys. And I guess I'll try to work through the agenda in the same way that we normally do. But if I've got problems, doing it from here on this computer, then maybe I'll ask the vice mayor to take over the leadership of the meeting. So we'll see how it goes. Glad to see everybody there, though, that's there. Brian is staying home because Rachel is positive for COVID. So he won't, so he'll be zooming in. Probably Jim Mack will too, I assume.
One thing I could
Easily miss would be if a hand comes up online. So if I do, because I'm going to have several things on my small desktop here. So if I do, just let me know, please.
I'll be keeping an eye out for that kind of stuff, and I'll interject if I think it the hand has been there for a while, or I'll kind of moderate that if you want.
Okay, yeah, and I could even miss seeing one of you in the room too. So we'll try to make it work. But this is a work session's informal, so we can talk over each other or whatever, or speak up at any time. It's okay.
Good evening. I have no audio. Thank you.
We'll get started soon, shortly here, Susan. Everybody, I guess we can get started. I don't see Brian Taylor or Jim Mack on. I hope they got the message of the new login info there. So they should be joining us presumably when they can do that. For our work session tonight, the main thing is to go through our agenda for the upcoming meeting. But if we could start with the reading of the vision statement, and I'm wondering if I could call on how about Council Member Owens to read that for us, would you please?
Mr. Mayor, we envision a distinctive community that prospers while and by protecting its natural resources with a sustainable economy and infrastructure that assures public health and safety while promoting personal development and initiative, and where all members take social responsibility and actively participate in decision making affecting growth, development, regulation, and enforcement, and in which people retain a closeness with, caring for each other individually and collectively, while working together to accomplish community goals and preserve community traditions.
Hey, thank you. And I'm going to try to, I've got to get my, bring my agenda or my packet back up on the screen here. Take me a sec.
Okay, so
Trying to balance everything on this screen. So a little small. We've got it on the screen now. So the, we'll start out our October meeting with the swearing in of new council members for seats C and D, followed by election of mayor and vice mayor. So I hope you're all thinking about what kind of leadership we'll have in the council for the next year, and give some good thought to that. We have our general meeting minutes. So I hope everybody's done that. I took a look at them when they came out, and they look good to me. We'll have staff reports from the fire chief, the city clerk, the marine facilities coordinator, the city treasurer with monthly financials, and city administrator report. And so I thought right now, though, I'd like to ask our city administrator, Kathy, if was there anything you want to report just right now, early, ahead of your more formal report for the general meeting? Is there something you'd like, any things you'd like to share with the council? You've been really busy traveling and representing us well up in Anchorage and Sitka at the various meetings. So are there some things you'd like to share with us?
I'll have a lot of them in my report, but there are a few things that I thought would be pertinent to bring up. One is, so the Alaska Energy Authority was there, and they're sort of tasked with a lot of things, including keeping the cost of energy lower in the state. And there was a lot of people bringing up the impending rate increase for electrical. Skagway will be challenging and appealing that. I know we're not going to be doing that, but they are. And I was talking to some of their folks about, I said, you guys are upset over a couple of cent increase and we're going to have three times as much. So we're glad somebody's appealing. And I did get a chance to talk to Jason Custer about why isn't it across the board how many cents per kilowatt hour instead of us getting exponentially hit by the percentage across the board increase. So I did have a chance to talk to him. He was there presenting on all of their broadband achievements. And I said, well, let's get some achievements on the electrical side too. So anyway, that was one item. I did get a chance to talk to the new Marine Highways Director, Craig Tornga, and we talked a little bit more about our rates that are being charged here for the port, you know, the port fees, and they did reword that so that people understand it's not something generated by the city. Unfortunately, they had a little glitch with the online one, and that's why they were charging two fees, but all those people got reimbursed. So that's taken care of. The other question that was asked of me, so Dan Lesh was there, and he is working for the Municipal League, but he's working on these big mariculture programs that there's a lot of funding out there for. And he had asked if there was any interest here. And I said, well, you know, we sent something out about that several months ago in our news group, and we didn't get any response. But he said he'd be happy to come over here and do a presentation on what all that's about for potential business or economic development in the area. And I think that would be a really good idea if we could get enough interest. So I was thinking about sending something out in the news group, trying to solicit interest for that. And Bobby Hudson would also participate because that is her business for the Pacific Northwest mariculture folks. And she'll be coming up in November too. So they could do a joint presentation on what that would look like. so I don't know how the council feels about it, but I think it would be worth our while to look at another economic development component in the area. So we might have something, you know, besides tourism. there was a lot of sectionals, a lot of meetings, a lot of group participation at both the Infrastructure Development Symposium and at the Southeast Conference. Our DRC project is still being considered. It hasn't hit the full Senate yet, but it's being considered. So it hasn't been dropped out yet. It's part of Senator Murkowski's requests, which has passed. And we hope it will continue to pass. one of the subjects that they brought up had to do with, is our spending plan designed at all around economic development, or are we just sort of stockpiling money? And they talked about that with a lot of different communities. Now, granted, bigger communities have more funds available to, to provide for those opportunities, but it's something to consider moving forward. What are we doing to invest in economic development with our policies and procedures and stuff in the community? So that was kind of a really interesting, an interesting discussion. And then there was a lot of rent people at the symposium soliciting business from us and also paying attention to all of the various programs and projects and changes that have occurred as a result of how confusing all of the different grant applications have been and the criteria for those things. So that's kind of mostly everything in a nutshell, and I will have a more detailed report on some of the sectionals for the meeting. If anybody has any questions.
Anybody has questions for Kathy, please chime in.
Okay, I'm not seeing anything coming up
on liner in the window there. So, okay, thanks, Kathy. We'll look forward to the complete dissertation of your last month here. So, at the general meeting, we have one item on the consent agenda. And it's introduction for the amendment of city held accounts in FY24. I guess the best thing to do is to go now to the treasurer and have him lead us through that item and show you what he's got.
Thank you, Mike. So this is basically the NCO that we spoke about back, I think we started talking about it really in May, but when we put the budget together, we wanted to keep the carryover as low as possible at the time to balance the budget, knowing that after the fiscal year had been closed out, we would have more money that we could carry over, and we would adjust the different departments' budgets accordingly. So we've asked the departments to provide us with their, some kind of documentation on what they thought they needed beyond what we budgeted for the fiscal year. And that's what this is. I can't tell. Is there actually a copy of it in the packet? Does everybody have this? So I'll wait until
I've got it right on the screen here.
Yeah. So anyways, I can go through it line by line, or I can answer questions. Basically, what we did is we added in each department except for the landfill. I shorted their building maintenance budgets knowing that we were going to do this. And so each department has their building maintenance budgets have been increased back to the same levels that they were at last fiscal year. So each department has that. Because of the city clerk situation, we added more money into training and travel. Lisa will need to do things that Karen wasn't necessarily going to need to do. So we added some money in there for that, for the new council members. I subtracted out $6,000 from payroll. That's money that Karen, that would have gone to Karen's salary, that we're not going to use for Lisa. That $6,000 is actually on paper is going to go towards the new EMS position to help. That $6,000 will help pay for the $8,000 that we expect that position to cost between now and December 31st. The landfill had a few older items, equipment items that they weren't necessarily going to replace, but that they thought that if there was a little bit of money left over that they would like to replace. So I added in $1,250 for that. We added in more money based on the recommendations that we got from Dr. Vaught, et cetera, for the fire department as far as training, travel. Seoul had, I don't remember what the equipment. I have it here, 1 second. Seoul wanted to add a additional training bag. They got a new so they weren't using the new bag for training. So we added in some money for that. Well, that's kind of just more of the same. The library, I did their building maintenance, the fire department's building maintenance. And then we added in the library requested the $5,500 to bring their library materials budget back up to last year's levels. So we added that in, and they asked to have their program supplies budget increase. Actually said supplies, but the items that were on it, I'm assuming that they were program supplies. If that's wrong, I can scratch the word program out. And then we also added $31,000 in road maintenance. That was based on the $6,000 for the gravel pit RFQ. The lowest bid came in at $6,100. We added $6,000 for that, and then $25,000 to the overall road maintenance to bring it up to what we spent last year on the road maintenance minus snow plowing. Because snow plowing is kind of a set amount, and I assume we'll talk about that later. And so the total is $69,025 in additional expenses. And so that was what I added to the carryover out of the approximately $348,000 that we had available to carry over. So does anyone have any questions about any of that? Shelly?
On, let's see, page 47, it looks like there may be a typo here, the GVFD payroll expenses, amended budget of 8,000, yes. Change 2,000.
Yes, I'm okay. Sorry. You're absolutely right. That should say 84,000. Well, I guess it should be $90,831, not $8,000. $8,000 should be the change. Thank you for pointing that out.
Okay.
Then GVFD payroll expenses. The original budget's $82,831.17. The amended budget should be $90,831.17, and the change is $8,000.
And then the other question I had is the this is almost 70% above our approved budget, I guess. So, is it likely that this increase will be used as the base for next year's budget? In other words, are we basically sort of doubling our budget by?
We're not doubling the budget. It's the original budget amount. So the surplus carryover was 100,000. That was what we originally carried over. We've added 69,000 to it. Last year, the surplus carryover was 300,000. So we've actually lowered it by $131,000. Mm-hmm. Is this the base for next year? I would assume that we would try to balance the budget when we balanced the budget, I had hoped that that would be the end of the budget. I knew that we would be doing NCOs, but I didn't know how much we would be carrying over. But I would say that I would hope that we would be able to do something similar to what we did this year, which was bring the disaster relief, the $50,000. Mm-hmm. We brought that forward. We did bring $35,000 forward for the audit. Hopefully we won't have to have another audit next year, but I would hope that we would base the carryover on things like the disaster relief money that we were planning to spend this year that we didn't, that we would think we were spending next year, not just carrying over, you know, like they did in the past, $300,000. And that way, you know, there was budgets balanced because we carried over $300,000. I would hope that we wouldn't do that.
Yeah, especially considering that we're not going to have the hundreds of thousands of dollars in federal money that we've been getting the last couple of years. Exactly. And here's a question I've had for you that I couldn't find it in the budget that I was looking for. Is there a number for our approved operating budget? Is there a single number? And I'm referring, of course, to the, one of my favorite topics, the AMLIP Reserve Fund.
Yes, the budget came in, the approved budget for fiscal year 2023 was $1.178 million. I'm not sure after the $1.178, but I can get that.
Okay, like. No, that's I was just looking for ballpark. Thanks.
Okay, yep.
And I think we can add that we have on our agenda the NCO to put all that money in that minimum amount into the AMLIP reserve per this plan.
That'll be. Oh,
and I guess I should. Am I also correct? We actually had a lot more carryover than we're using. Here we're just appropriating a portion of that carryover. To as revenue in this budget, the rest of it's going into our various savings accounts, like the reserve account and the long-term capital savings and that sort of thing. So We're not by any means using all the carryover that we had last year. So still makes for a pretty conservative budget compared to our anticipated revenue.
Yes, a follow-up. Will that AMLIP funding be in next Monday's meeting? I guess I don't see it on the agenda.
Yeah, so I don't have a copy of the agenda, but it's definitely one of the three NCOs that are in the next.
So I actually had the MLIP reserve NCO as well as the capital current transfer under the new business. And with your permission, I'd like to move them both up to the consent agenda as well. So those are in there.
Okay, thank you. That's the, I guess, items 14 and 15 on the current agenda.
Yes.
Mike, I think they're asking for your permission to move those items to the consent agenda.
Well, yeah, we can do that if everybody wants to do that. It's only an introduction. So we often do introductions put them on the consent agenda. And then if somebody wants to move it off in the general meeting, of course they can. But it's only an introduction. So, we can put that on consent agenda.
Okay, thank you.
But let's leave it for right now. Let's do them in order on our draft agenda. But then the clerk can move those two things up to a consent agenda unless after we discuss them, somebody wants to keep them, under new business. That's also okay. Just takes a few, just a minute or two longer that way, but it's not a big deal. Okay. Budget adjustment has been, an important thing. Everybody's been really interested in it. I mean, everybody on the council concerned when we were going to get it done, and it, to be sure, took us longer. I apologize for estimating for originally that we might be able to do it as early as August, but it took longer to close out some of the stuff and also to get in a good idea of what the various departments needed and work it up. So posting it now is turned out to be what we could do, and we'll take action on it in November. In the meantime, all the departments have plenty of money in their budget to get them. They're not depending on this to spend it in October or November. So, but they'll know it's in the pipeline and they can count on it because I don't expect any opposition to develop for these adjustments for these departments. I think the departments have really thought carefully about what they needed. And I appreciated the work they put into it to help document what how they would use the extra money or the fill-in money that they are asking for. So do any of you have any questions on that now? That this is the best time if you thought there was something missing on this or whatever.
Okay, Mr. Mayor, this is Shelley.
Sure.
Can we stop by City Hall and look at the documentation from the departments, the justification for the increases?
Certainly.
Ben is nodding.
Certainly, I'm sure our treasurer would be glad to spend whatever time any council member needs to see how we came up with this. But we'll have it on the agenda for introduction this month and public hearing next month and adoption next month. Okay? Any other questions? So there's more time to learn more about this and even to adjust it if we feel that it'd be beneficial. So fortunately, we've got the money to do this, and we're not even using all the carryover that we ended up having. Okay, so I guess we're we can move on to item 11, our Title III personnel change. This is public hearing. Remember, we've gone over this thing, and essentially we were taking out the holidays for this and saying that holidays will be covered in our policy and procedure for benefits. I'd like to call on Kathy, please, to give us another quick rundown on what all's in here, what we'll be voting on next Monday to approve.
I believe that this is just the ordinance change, which takes, we already passed the policy and procedure. This is the ordinance change that had to have a hearing first, which removes the holiday provision out of the ordinance.
Correct. And was there anything else? I've forgotten if there was.
No.
Anything the else in that?
Didn't have anything else other than the holiday issues in it. So that's where we said we were taking it out and we would deal with it in the policy and procedure, which was passed last meeting.
Right. Okay. Do any council members have any questions about that? Maybe everybody remembers what we were doing. Okay. Looks like Brian has his hand up. Brian?
Can y'all hear me?
We do.
Okay, great. Just to make sure I'm looking at this right, I just want to be sure. We've got the copy we have here is, it's just what's been stricken through that's being removed. Not seeing, I'm just scrolling over this and realizing it's just a lot of verbiage. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything, but yeah, it does just look like it's just that one section. Oh, I see. It has the date that it's going to be repealed already written on there as well. Okay. So I'm guessing it's just that one. What is that? Section 3.05.020.
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks for clarifying. Just wanted to make sure I wasn't missing something on that.
The other questions there in the room or?
Yes. So I don't know if this is where we should talk about this, but, or if this, what I have to say is on a whole different point, but there was discussion about some of the other changes to these benefits that had to do with some wording in terms of who would be considered family for sick leave and then changing the idea of whether the sick leave needed to be approved. And at the end of the meeting, the discussion, it was, well, we'll pass this now so that it will get passed by this month and be timely. But then you had said, we'll talk about the rest of it at the October meeting. And so based on the letter that we got from one of the community members and testimony we had, I went through and looked at some other policies and I've of other places and standard ones that you find like online. And I've come up with just some very, I think, simple edits that could improve our policy. And so I don't know if we want to talk about it now or if this goes under unfinished business. And I have copies for people to look at what I suggest.
Yeah, Janine, we're working through the agenda as we have it now for the next meeting. But I did have written down on my notepad here to ask you to bring forward your ideas on the on policy and procedure changes and what you want to do about that after we get through the agenda. So could we do that? And we'll tick that up as a topic at that point.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Okay, so that we'll have public hearing on item 11, and vote to approve or not approve that change next week. And that takes us on to new business. And the first will be an award of the RFQ for the emergency gravel stockpile. And we had three bids. Here you can see them on the screen. So we will have a motion to award the contract to the low bidder, who is Glacier Bay Construction, at $6,100 for setting up that emergency gravel stockpile for us. And that pile is going to be down at the Boat Harbor area next to the, you're probably all aware of where that big pile of 6-inch minus rock is, right in that area as we drive off on the road headed towards the new septic storage facility. It'll be there on the left. So any questions on this item? And I can't see you in the room here the way that the screen is right now, so.
No one's in the room has any questions.
Go ahead, question there, anybody? Okay, so we're all okay with that. Sorry, it's a little rough for me working this way on my little screen. Okay, then I guess that's, we've got that item on the agenda. We can go on to the next item. Screen here.
Mike, if you're talking, we can't hear you.
Okay, I wasn't talking. I was just waiting for it to come up on the screen so I could see it. Sorry. Hang on a sec here. Of it, so I can't, because I was having trouble reading it off the screen. So okay, the next, I think actually one problem can be if I click on something else in my screen, I think the microphone goes off. So so the next item is what to do about the snow plowing situation for the winter. And so that's item 13. We put out an RFQ following the model that we've used in the past, and we got no bids on it. And this isn't the first time that we've had that problem. In fact, I remember back when I was mayor in about 2016, I think the first time I was mayor, we immediately had this problem. And we tried a bunch of different ways to get snow plowing underway and finally managed to make it work. And snow plowing is if you're not aware of it, is a real problematic thing for a contractor. A lot of people just don't want to do it. The insurance prices for municipal snow plowing are exceedingly high. And it's sort of ridiculous for us here because we don't have the problems that they have in a city when you're plowing a regular city and you got cars parked on the roads and you've got mailboxes and all kinds of stuff, kids they can run into. We don't have much of that problem here. But regardless, our snowplowers are stuck paying the rates, and that makes it really difficult. There's also the problem of the contractor never knows how much snow there's going to be or when it's going to be. So they have to have their equipment ready, whether it snows or not, and they have to be hanging around here. They can't go to Arizona for 2 months in the middle of the winter because they're sitting here wondering if it'll snow, and maybe it doesn't. You know, so yeah, all these things make it really hard. And so we're continuing to try to figure out ways to do this better and make it work better for the contractor. Last year, we solved some of that problem and finally got an agreement with Glacier Bay Construction by putting in a minimum amount of snow plowing that we would pay for the season, whether it snowed or not. In other words, we're paying them to be ready to plow, have their equipment here, be here, and plow when we need it to, and giving them enough money to make it worth their while. Remember, nobody has to do this for us, and it's our problem, so we've kind of got to figure out how to do it. And that was one way that worked last year. We didn't have a minimum put into the project this time, but that wasn't necessarily the only reason that there were no bids. At any rate, Glacier Bay Construction has, has offered, since we didn't get a bid from anybody, they have offered to plow again this year as an extension of last year's contracts with the same rates as last year, no increases for inflation or anything, and the same minimum. That is, I think, about the best option that we could have at this point. Otherwise, we've got to try to put out another RFQ or an RFP or something like that and come up with a different model. And we still may not be successful. So we have an offer from them to extend their contract from last year. They're public spirited. They want to, you know, they know the community needs to have the roads plowed. And so they made us that offer. And I feel it's very generous of them. I really appreciate it. So we will have on the agenda a motion to extend the contract from last year into a second year at the same prices and with the same minimum. And so that's the plan. Do any of you have any questions about that?
I do.
Again, I'm not seeing the room here, so.
This is Shelley, Mr. Mayor.
Sure, Shelley.
So the continuation of the contract, does that also have that sort of retainer type agreement with them for a minimum? It does. Okay.
It does.
And then.
Yes.
The other question I had, since this is actually just a continuation of last year, it's page 54 of the packet. It's calling out the contractor to plow snow on specified roads before 12 inches of fresh snow has accumulated. I guess I'm curious about that provision. 12 inches, of course, that's quite a lot of snow to get through. And I'm wondering what specified roads means. I mean, this isn't a big deal if this is just a continuation of something we've already agreed to. But I was wondering what that terminology meant. Page 54 of the packet, 29 of the standard specifications for local road maintenance.
Well, I think what I can, answer without trying to go to that on my screen here. When I adopted this snow plowing thing from the Fairbanks North Star Borough system that I knew when I was on the road commission up there, they had a minimum amount of snowing just that we would call out at least at that point, if not sooner, so that the contractor didn't have to worry that we were going to let the snow build up to 3 feet and then tell them to plow it for the same rate that they would plow 5 inches or something. Now, we don't let it go to 12 inches. excuse me. We work with them in advance when we know we've got a snowfall coming. We're planning usually 2 or 3 days ahead about when we think we're going to plow, and we certainly want them out there plowing a lot sooner than 12 inches if we can do that. And with the minimum amount that we're paying them for the year, we'll probably call them out more often than we would otherwise, because we'll make good use of our money if we do that. So we're hoping to keep the roads more clear of snow under this arrangement than we might otherwise. But of course, the cost is a little higher than it has been in the past. Does that help?
Yes.
Okay, thanks for asking about it. Any other questions on this?
I'd like to begin.
Oh, sorry.
Sure, Brian.
So I guess you've mentioned that we're continuing at the same, or we're looking at continuing it with the same rate as we have in the past. Do you have the number on what that rate for the snow plowing contract was? Like, I don't see it here in the packet that I have in front of me.
The budget for that is $65,000.
Okay, thank you. And then just, go ahead.
Well, just one thing I want, no, finish yours first. There was just something I wanted to add to all of that at the end, if I can.
Yeah, of course. What I wanted to say, I just double checking that I'm understanding what I'm looking at here in the packet. This list of the, you know, with the general provisions, the cover sheet, this is the RFQ that we got no responses to, right? So is there, do we have a copy of the contract that we would be continuing? Because it, or is it relatively or essentially the same as what we have in front of us right now?
No. This was going to be a sort of a little bit of a different model. If you'd like a copy of last year's contract, we can provide that.
Yeah, I'd be curious just to read over it. But mostly you wanted to make sure I wasn't, you know, reading super deeply into this, expecting it to be the contract and then learning that it, or having my understanding corrected that it's not. So I appreciate having that set straight.
Yeah, this is Mike. One thing we tried to include in this contract for this year that turned out to be problematic was to put sanding into it. And that made it less attractive to the contractors because it meant they had to be contractually bound to sand if we ask them to. And nobody really has a good sander here. Last year, we contracted on the side of the of our snow plowing contract, sort of off contract for sanding in a few times when it got really slick and dangerous. We can still do that if it's acceptable to the contractor or whoever might have the sand. So sanding is sort of off contract, but we anticipate that we can do some of it. We just can't easily do a lot of it, and we can't put it into the contract that they have to do it. It just wasn't going to work. So I think that it's something that will, by removing it from the, by going back to last year's contract, which did not have sanding in it, that makes it a little easier for the contractor to do the snow plowing, and we can still work with them probably to get some sanding work or some sand spread one way or another if we really need to, like say the library parking lot, which could be a real, that ramp up to the road there could be slick. So things like that, we can still find ways to do that. But we could provide, in fact, we could even, I suppose, put into the packet last year's RFQ as the basis of the contract, because that's what we'll be using. That will be the operative contract for this year. Does that help?
If I might add a couple of things. So I know you were concerned about the 12 inches of snow. And one of the things last year, we probably could have called them out a few more times, but we were trying to be conservative, not knowing how much snow we were going to have to be able to, you know, complete that budget. So there were some days where maybe there was only 4 inches that we could have called them out to do. But again, we were not anticipating we wouldn't have that much snow. So that's part of it. The other part of it is, so this year we can be a little more prudent with maybe calling them out a little more often. Hopefully we won't get dumped on. But the other part of that is the sanding that we did do, they were able to get a truck and kind of hold it together with baling wire and all kinds of things for the machine. But because we did have money on the table that hadn't been used, they billed the sanding against that amount. So they didn't charge us extra outside of that contract. They billed because there was money on the table. They put it towards the sanding part. So that was nice of them to do that. They didn't have to, but they did. And I believe they'd probably do the same again if there's still money on the table from this contract. So
can you just kind of go over then what it means? That so there's a minimum amount that we pay them, and this for that, then are we paying them one amount no matter what, or how does it work?
So we have a certain amount. Let's just say that we got five times as much snow last year, we would have run out of money. We don't pay them that no matter what. That's what they don't want to do. But we do pay them what was left on the table, that at the minimum.
At the minimum.
Yes.
And then if they go beyond that minimum amount, then there's a rate that they get paid extra, is what you're saying.
I believe so, yes. There is no, it's not all or nothing. It's all, whether we use it or not. And then if we use it, we would have to add.
Okay.
Yeah, I can add to that. The snowplow contract, the way we do it, has unit prices. And there's a per mile price that we apply to all the roads. And then the various lots and pads and so forth have unit prices for each of them. And so when they bill it, they say, we plowed so many miles of road, and then we plowed the five or six lots or whatever they are at their rates. And so the total is such and such for that plowing, for that event. So that's how it actually gets billed. But what we've said is that we will, if they don't get up to the minimum, we'll pay them the rest of that minimum anyway, because they had to buy the insurance and they had to have the equipment ready and all that stuff. And they were prepared to plow. Now, if we have a really heavy snow year, we could easily go beyond that minimum. And in that case, the charges just keep adding up on based on the unit prices in the RFQ. Okay.
So
okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just gonna, maybe someone mentioned this, but you'll put last year's contract in the packet so that everyone can see it, so the council can vote on it.
Right. I would say yes.
Yes. I did send a
yeah.
copy to Brian. If anybody else would like, I can email anybody in here a copy, but we will get it in the packet. And just to clarify, if it's okay, that last year the snow plowing came to around $50,000. And then we paid the additional $15,000 to get to the minimum.
But we have had years where we plowed a lot more than we did last year. So we'll hope not this year. Supposed to be a warmer winter with El Nino, but we'll see. Who knows? It's hard. Every El Nino is a little different. Okay, so we're ready to go on to the next item.
If I can jump in with one other question on this, looking at this contract that's in the packet, as well as the one that was sent last year, or that we were basically re-signing this year. I'm just curious about we're looking at let's see, it's got a label here. Basically the price specifications in the bid schedule, and none of them have a unit cost. So, you know, we have like line items broken out into the type of thing that's going to be performed there. And item number 215 is plowing, and it says the pay unit is per each for the different sections of the, I guess, town, you know, whether that's the community chest parking lot or the library driveway and parking, but none of them have a unit cost. So is that right. something that's been negotiated in the contract? Because I just am curious how we count up to get to the number if it's the number's not in the contract.
Okay. Yeah, then the unit prices get entered on the bid sheet. What you're looking at is the spec sheet that doesn't change. And in fact, those spec sheets are in a standard format that's used in state and municipal engineering contracts throughout Alaska and probably nationwide. That those are sort of standard spec sheets, although we edit them to apply to Gustavus in some cases. But so that's just the specification sheet that says what snow plowing, what's supposed to be done when it's snow plow, when they snow plow. And there's, we have similar sheets for grading and ditch pulling and brush clearing and so forth. And they all have at the bottom a thing about what the pay unit is, but the price is not there. Those sheets don't change year to year, but the bids do. So if you look on the bid sheet for the RFQ, you'll see that there's a place where the bidder enters the unit price that they are bidding to do that that particular task. So for plowing of roads, they will enter a price per mile. And then for the boat harbor, boat ramp and so forth, they'll enter a unit price for doing the boat harbor. So that's where the prices show up.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. I guess if we're going to, and really, I mean, it seems like we don't have, you know, a ton of options on how we go forward on this, but I mostly for my personal curiosity, but also for transparency and us understanding what it is we're voting on, would be awesome if it's possible for us to have that information all together so that we can have it to review for the packet, at least for the next meeting.
Yes, let's include with the RFQ what the unit prices were that were bid last year, because those are the ones that will prevail. So it'll be the same as they bid last year and as we accepted and awarded the contract last year.
In addition, there was some roads which they wouldn't do before, but they will do now because we've done the turnarounds. So those were not plowable before, and they are now.
Yeah, that's sort of the case. They plowed some that we didn't have complete turnarounds on because the snow wasn't very great. But had it been a lot worse, those probably wouldn't have been done. And we have fixed those turnarounds in the last year or last 2 years. So that's going to help make it easier for them to plow everything. They always do the best they could possibly do with our difficult conditions. Our roads are narrow. Sometimes we've got too much brush on them, although we're trying to cut the brush. We got trees that are close to them. We've got people with an anchor or something out in the edge of their roadside. And then we've got all of the bite net posts to go around. And, it's not easy. So, please join me in appreciating the quality of the service that we've been getting and that we will continue to get. Okay. Looks like the next one is our item 14, FY24 NCO AMLIP Reserve. Mr. Treasurer, would you please give us a review on this item?
So this is the based on updating the AMLIP policy the last general meeting. This is the NCO to get the AMLIP reserve account up to $1,178,508.74, which is the budget that was approved for FY24. What I did is I closed out the AMLIP road maintenance account. I haven't officially closed it out. I'm closing it out per the council's direction, moving $251,000 plus into the reserve. And then in order to get the reserve up to the $1.178 million, I also had to move $137,767.55 from capital improvement long-term into the AMLIP reserve account as well. So that's what this is getting our AMLIP reserve account in compliance with the new AMLIP policy.
Thank you. Any questions? Speak up if you're in the room and I'm not, because I'm not seeing you.
No one in the room.
For some reason, I don't have the room view showing up on my screen here. I don't know why, but.
Yeah, I was going to comment. It looks like the camera got turned off there. I'm not sure exactly.
Oh, yeah, that's, there is a.
Yeah, it's just showing black. A little profile picture.
Maybe you can get that back on, but it would help. At any rate, speak up if you got any more questions about what we're doing. But this answers that earlier question that I think Shelley had. Aha, now that's looking a little better. Okay, so we're good on that one then. That we're introducing that, right? Okay, the next is FY24 XXNCO capital current transfer, also for public hearing next month. Mr. Treasurer?
So again, to be in compliance with the new AMLIP policy, this is moving the money from the AMLIP current accounts that we've spent in the last month back into long-term out of the AMLIP current account. There's a spreadsheet which will be included with the packet for the general meeting, which shows the amount of money in current for each department or each capital project, how much money was spent in the month, and how much money is remaining. This is how it'll look on the NCOs. And so I the tower project is done, so that's why the amended balance is zero. All the money was spent. The library has a little bit of money left over, and they do still have a few things that they'd like to do. So we didn't close it out. We left the 1180 as the amended balance. And then the marine facility spent $209 of the of the fish waste disposal. Larry's still working on getting that thing all set up and ready for winter. So I moved the money back into capital improvement long term as a holding account for these funds. If anybody has any questions, this is also being introduced.
I've got a question if I could, Ben, just to make sure I'm understanding what this is going to look like going forward. So as we have a capital project that we appropriate funds for, is this like a sub account inside of the sub account where it's going to live in the AMLIP current account? And then I'm seeing money going into the long-term improvements, but it's not coming from the tower project. That money got spent, right? So theoretically that got sent out to our checking account to be spent, or no.
Yes, I can clear that up. So this is kind of the idea behind the policy, is that we didn't need this $38,000 in our checking account to pay for this bill. What would have ended up happening is I would have had to have done an NCO to move money out of our checking account to stay within the 17 to 35% that we should have of our annual operating budget. So because our checking account was high enough, we didn't need to move this money into our checking account. So we are now moving it back into capital improvement long-term. And the idea is to keep it in the AMLIP accounts and out of the checking account as long as that's feasible. Right now, because of the way the previous policy was, we did an NCO that moved the money into the checking account. We did an NCO that moved the money into the current account. We're now moving that money back into long-term. Once the money going forward, when a capital project is approved and the money is awarded, we'll do an NCO that moves the money both ways. It'll move the money to the current account And then from the current account, either into another account, whether it be checking account or capital long term. And that way we'll only have to do the one NCO. But until that time, as long as we're dealing with these NCOs that were done prior to the AMLIP change, we're going to have to NCO that money back the traditional way that they had always been doing it. But we were able to pay these bills, this $76,079, without moving any money from AMLIP into our checking account, and still keep our checking account above the, or in the 17 to 35% range.
Okay, perfect. Yep, that's making sense. I have this recurring memory failing about how our city basically has cash flowing in all the time,
right?
Not appropriating directly to AMLIP. So that, thank you for bearing with me there. And I guess when we do see the first of these, I guess adjusted or newer NCOs that has, you know, the both of the actions into the current account and back, and how, as you're describing, I'm sure you will, but please be sure to flag that, because I'm really interested to see what that's going to look like.
Yes, no problem. There also, if I could just say before we move on, and unless there's more questions, is we currently have our checking account at 22% of our annual operating budget, which is inside that 17 to 35%. And I think I would say it's probably the first time. I'd have to go way back to see any time where that's ever been the case, because the policy has always been to move all of the capital project funds into the account. So regardless of whether the money was being moved out or not, the account was never actually in that range. So thank you guys for allowing me, or for helping me get to this point.
Any other questions about what we're doing here? In a way, this allows us to see what's really left in those accounts. In the case of the fire department tower, that project's entirely done. We no longer need to show any money as appropriated for that project. So essentially that line goes away. The balance goes to zero for it. And we're making that appropriation that was shown in the AMLIP account available in a long term, you know, for reappropriation. And the case of the library one, we still have $1,180.78. We've got a few small capital items we'd like to do there, like maybe a new picnic table, a foldable one in there, they've suggested, and a new bike rack, because the old one's pretty beat up. So we thought we could do those out of that, and we might put some stain on the outside of the plywood on it too. We might be able to do all that within that $1,100. We'll just have to see what we can get done. So that's kind of how that's working. It just helps us see what we've got appropriated still for projects and what's left. Okay, so that was item 15, right? So that takes us to item 16. We have a write-off of some ambulance bad debt, and we have to do this about every 2 or 3 years. Usually these are for cruise ship transfers that we do, and somebody's out of state, maybe they don't have insurance, and so it's impossible to collect those things. And so, Mr. Treasurer, do you want to give us a review of what we're doing, how much we're writing off here and so forth?
Yes. So after Phoebe left, the process kind of ground to a halt on this. The procedure for writing off bad debt for the ambulance says that in January, the treasurer shall discuss with our billing agency uncollected accounts have had no activity within the last 180 days. Based on that, we would come up with a recommendation for the city council. That hasn't happened. And I think I've mentioned a few times that it's rather confusing, our system of billing and accounting for it for the ambulance. So it would make it easier for me moving forward if we could go ahead and take care of FY20, FY21, and FY22. In FY20, we have one one uncollectible debt out of state. In FY21, we have two out of state. And in FY22, we actually have four, one of which is not out of state. Three are out of state and all deemed uncollectible by our billing company. And the local resident has also been deemed uncollectible as uninsured at time of service. So they have stopped their efforts at collecting, and I would like to write off. For some reason, I don't have the total amount. I think it's $4,334, I think, is the total of the three fiscal years. We do still have two things left from FY23, but I'd like to get that on track with what the policy says. In January, I'd like to sit down and discuss whether or not what we would like to do going forward. At the tax conference that I just went to, it's tax and bad debt are two different things, but one of the things that they talked about was the use of collection agencies, when it's feasible and when it's not. And they said if it's under $10,000, it's not necessarily worth the municipality's effort to go after these people, because you're going to end up spending more money than you're trying to collect. And so so that's kind of the basic situation. I would like to write this off. It would, like I said, it would make things easier for me. It should have been done 3 years running, and it wasn't. So if we could do that, then in January we could get back on track and doing it as the procedure states in our policy.
Okay, when we put this on our agenda, maybe we can list write-off of whatever the amount is, $4,562, whatever it is, dollars in uncollectible ambulance debt. So it's clear in the title what it is. And then we'll have to have a motion written up for one of us to offer that with the right numbers and everything in it. Is that okay?
So Mike, if I could interrupt, I wrote, I don't know if this is appropriate because I haven't wrote any motions, but based on what you told me via email, I wrote that I, being whoever makes the motion, move that the city of Gustavus writes off the following ambulance service debts from fiscal years 20 for FY20 for $620.90, FY21 for $1,241.80, FY22 for $2,469.30 is uncollectible. And there's a brief little statement underneath that explains why it's uncollectible.
Perfect. That'd be just right. Thanks. Okay. Our agenda is running off my screen, but I think that's the last item in our agenda. Am I correct? What we show on item 17, that was item 10, right? We just listed it twice here.
Yeah, that was my fault. Still learning.
No problem. Okay, so that's that. That's the agenda. And we could go on I'd like to call on Janine to say what she'd like to do with policy and procedure on benefits and so forth.
Yes, thanks, Mike. So at our last discussion, when we were looking at the changing of some of the benefits, I know that the intent was just to be very limited as to what the benefit was to be changing, but we got the whole thing put in front of us. And in reading through it, there were some comments that I think other people had and that I had myself in terms of some changes I'd like to have made. And I think these changes should be fairly simple. What I've given out, and unfortunately, Brian, you won't have a copy, although you could email him one, and Mike as well, unless he's got it in front of him. So I went through and looked at a variety of other benefit packages and how they were, standard templates or something online for some, looking to see basically the thing that strikes me is was that an employee needed to ask permission for sick leave. And that was one part of our discussion last month. And we agreed that in order not to hold up the changes that were going to be made about the insurance time period, we wouldn't look at these last month, but we would look at them this month. And so I've written up a few suggestions. And I started by putting on this document that we have in a timekeeping payroll section that says that employees will sign their, it already says, employees will sign their time records at the end of each pay period to certify the accuracy of all time recorded. Timesheets may be sent electronically. And this is the sentence I think that clarifies, and it's already in here, why it's not needed to have a supervisor approve the payroll in order to make the payroll happen correctly. Because it already says it here, the supervisor will review and initial the time record before submitting it for payroll processing. In addition, if corrections or modifications are made to the time record, both employee and the supervisor must verify the accuracy of the changes by initialing the time record. So this is already there. When we had the discussion and we said, well, why is it that the supervisors need to approve the sick leave? The rationale given was so that the payroll would be correct. But that rationale seems to not be needed because it's already taken care of in this section under the 306 on timekeeping. So if what I suggesting that we change is to say that when employees want to use their sick leave, they should notify their supervisor as soon as possible, either through email or personal contact. We will handle all sick leave requests with discretion. And so that I think would be a simple way to let employees know how they should, what they need to do when they wake up sick. And so rather than, it takes away the idea of that someone other than the employee and is making the decision of how to use their sick leave. So that is one, that's the wording that I'm suggesting. And then based on Tanya's comment when in our discussion about to define which family members you can take sick leave for, I'm suggesting we write this benefit can be used for personal sick time to care for immediate family members, including the employee's spouse, children, mother, and father, and travel to doctor's appointments or care facility. Absence for periods that exceed 3 working days may require a doctor's note or other documentation of the requirement for the absence from a professionally recognized care provider. So it seems that these are some just simple words that could be changed, and it would, I think, show that we aren't wanting to be in charge of whether a person decides they need to take sick leave.
Comments, questions from others there?
This is Tanya. I like it a lot. That's great that you found that the ordinance already has some of the stuff. We don't have to keep put it all in there.
I can't hear you very well.
I like it. I guess the only thing I'm a little bit questioning is spouse. It says including employee's spouse, children, mother, and father. Maybe something like spouse/life partner in case people aren't married. Sure. I just Googled what immediate family means, and it's parent, siblings, spouse, children. So there's also siblings are considered immediate, at least generative AI. I don't like that. I'm going to look. It's a better source like Wikipedia. But I like it very much, but maybe include life partner and siblings.
Sure. Yeah. And that's why I wanted to bring it up to the, during a work session. So we could have some conversation about it. I always find it really frustrating that we can't just like send out an email to everyone and see what people's ideas are. And so, yes, I think that'd be a good change or addition So including employee spouse slash life partner, comma, siblings, children, mother and father. Any other suggestions or ideas?
I am curious. I kind of like, without having the wording in front of me, it's really hard to quote exactly what you said, but you were basically simplified the approval of sick leave to, you know, we will use discretion. And I like the double entendre there of, you know, we'll be discreet and use discretion. So we're not going to go, you know, blabbing about whatever you're sick about. And also we'll use our good judgment about whether or not this is, you know, valid sick leave to approve. I wonder if anyone else had any thoughts about or concerns about that not being clear or that being too vague, or if everyone else is all happy with the wording there. At first, I heard it and went, I don't know if that's a little bit on the vague side. And then I looked up the definition of discretion and went, actually, double entendre is pretty nice. But that was one of the things that struck me. And I would actually, as on the subject of, you know, who you're able to take sick leave to care for, I would support an even more generous definition there to, you know, care for your grandparents or, you know, whoever people, you know, I would be happy to open that up to, you know, human who is close to you, but I have a hard time imagining people are going to take advantage of that. But I am decidedly liberal in that sense, at least. So happy to hear thoughts on that, but I feel like we could even open that up more.
Councilman Taylor, it should be in your inbox.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any other comments there in the room?
Along the same lines as Brian, of maybe leaving it as immediate family. Do we need to further clarify, or can someone make a decision based on who they consider their immediate family? Just a thought.
And my thoughts are that
say what I think about this. Frankly, I don't think we've got a problem that needs any action here. And right now, I'm not in favor of making a change to the policy and procedure for what I think is largely wordsmithing. It's not a, the wording on that policy and procedure was carefully worked out several years ago with the council based on, you know, and it reflects input from our HR advisor, if we go way back in it, but the wording is the same as in all kinds of municipalities and other employers. It's perfectly okay to approve for the supervisor to approve both annual leave and sick leave. Now, it doesn't mean the supervisor is making any decision about whether the person's really sick or not or anything like that, but they do approve the leave for both vacation leave and sick leave. I don't think we've had a problem with it, frankly. I don't think it's enough of a policy change here to make it worth spending the time on and going through the process. The rest of you may feel differently, and if you do, that's fine. We can do that. But what we'll have, the next step would be for the proposers to come up with a written resolution and a draft of the change to the policy and procedure and put it on the November agenda. Right now it's not on our agenda, and I don't think anybody's going to be able to do all that stuff by Wednesday at noon. So at this point, I'm not too excited about it. I think some of those wording, you know, it's not that the wording is necessarily bad. It isn't. A lot of it could have been just that way had it been done before, but I don't think it's enough of a change to really be worth the time to deal with at this point. But so that's my view. Sorry, Janine, to be less than enthusiastic about the work you've done on this one.
So I appreciate your feedback. I'm though still looking at the comment initially in terms of our the benefit can be used for personal sick leave, sick time to care for. And what the original one says was for immediate family members within employee's household. And that is something that we had a discussion that, and it's, as we are talking now, that that seems very limiting. And so one option could be just to strike that word within the employee's household and just say, as been suggested, sick time to care for immediate family members, and leaving it open to that rather than defining who they are. That, because what change would be is that was the problem was that a lot of people were saying that there are lots of instances when people consider their family members to be those beyond who's living in their household. And so maybe it hasn't been a problem in the past, but I'm suggesting we go through and do this as proactively, and that we could, it's even a simpler thing is to just take out the line that says within the employee's household and then not define who or what is family, immediate family members. I would totally, you know, go with that. And I hear you saying it's not been a problem in the past, but I, as a council member, don't feel that I have any role in a document that says a supervisor has to approve sick leave. And it seems a very, very simple point that we could just instead put the sentence, when employees want to use their sick leave, they should notify their supervisor as soon as possible, either through email or personal contact. We will handle all sick leave requests with discretion. I think that's a very simple statement to put in. I don't see that it's, we made a change so that we could make other changes to the policy. Why can't, I don't see why we can't make this change as well. And so I would definitely recommend that we go through with this and make these very, what I consider, I think, very simple changes that will show that we as an organization trust and value our employees.
In a change to the who constitutes family or whatever would be a, that would be a policy change, I think. It's more than wordsmithing, although probably the administration, most administrations that we'd have here in the city would be pretty liberal on that anyway. But if you want to, you know, tie that down and make it more clearly, you know, required, then the answer is to proceed and write the resolution and put it all into a rewritten or into a policy and procedure where you've taken the existing one and done track changes so everybody can see what you're proposing, and we'll put it on the agenda.
So in terms of the logistics of it, this document does have track changing, and the software that I have on my computer doesn't allow me to do that on the Adobe, on a PDF. And so I had to copy and paste it and into this Word document. And so it does have the track changing showing what I've suggesting. Although now, based on our conversation, I would suggest that we not include the definitions of who the immediate family members are and just say, this benefit can be used for personal sick time to care for immediate family members. I'm to care for immediate family members. And then taking away the part that says within the employee's household, as well as taking away any definition of who they are so that we don't have to get into the weeds on that.
Well, we can get you, I'm sure we can manage to get you a Word version of that so that you can actually work through it and produce us a version where we see the whole thing with the strikeouts, et cetera, in it. Right. And a resolution to go with it. You know, you have to have a resolution, but that's pretty easy to write.
Okay, so I can come in and maybe work with Lisa on it or something to get it together.
Exactly. But and if you got it, ready for next month, then I'm sure it can go on the agenda. That'll be up to the mayor, whoever they are.
I'd like to add something in here, if I might. So if you look at many cities' policies for this particular thing, you will see most of them say that they need to put in a lane request. We haven't had a problem with this before. If you just say when they want to use their sick leave, they can decide whenever that is, whenever they want, for whatever reason, and it ties our hands to not be able to ever do anything should there become any abuse for the whole thing. And that is why a lot of employers have that policy and they're about a leave request, because of the potential for abuse of sick leave. Now, a lot of employers have gone to all PTO and no sick leave, and people could use, you know, put the request in for whatever they want to put it in for, whether it's sick, whether it's time off. People were saying, I never get sick and I lose all my sick leave, and this person gets to take, you know, an extra month off because they use all their stuff, sick leave and PTO. So a lot of companies have gone and places have gone to just PTO. But if you remove that provision, you are going to tie our hands to be able to do anything should any abuse ever occur in the long term. And there's a reason why the lawyers were involved with getting this policy in place. I suggest you look at, which you've been sent, by the way, a bunch of other policies, PNPs on this stuff from other cities and municipalities. And ours already, the way it reads currently, is way less restrictive than even most of those places. So I am not in favor of changing the sick. I have no problem with changing the family member thing so that it's generic, but I do have a problem with us having our hands tied about not being able to approve sick leave. So that's my.
So I can appreciate that you would want to make sure that it's not abused. And so, but I think that we don't want to then basically, when it's not being abused, make it be that it has to be approved. So perhaps you could come up with a sentence or something that addresses if there's a reason to think that it's being, you know, abused, then such and such can happen.
Well, that's what other places
and
have.
And so if you, I mean, I wouldn't be opposed to, if you had something that you thought would be able to deal with that situation, that would certainly be something that would be appropriate to be in there. But I think that's separate from the idea that we could have the word sick leave has to be approved.
And I just disagree, so I'm not going to change my mind.
I mean, I'm looking at the policy and I don't see where that's struck out. Where does it say now that sick leave has to be approved currently in the current version?
Well, in the current version, it said an employee must receive approval for.
Oh, on the other side. Okay. No. Gotcha. Thanks.
I think it's the same wording, by the way, for PTO as it is for sick leave. Both of them say that they have to be approved by the supervisor.
And my thoughts are, having been in management and seeing that sick leave be abused, I would rather have something in language in place that, you know, would, I don't think we need to take away supervisory authority. I appreciate and thank Susan Warner for this proposed language that she sent, which I think is is sort of a midway between the two, you know, no supervisory approval to, you know, sort of having other things. And I would probably support language, you know, Susan's language, but I think that I don't think we need to be removing any authority of supervisors, even if we've never had a problem. You know, if you have a problem and you don't have the tool to correct it, then, you know, then you've got a problem. Not very articulate.
We have a plan then, In which you'll make us a resolution and a new version of that, working with Liesl, I guess.
Sure, yes.
Sounds good. Okay, we'll look forward to seeing what you come up with.
All right.
And yeah. some of these arguments will probably rear up again. So, okay. Does anybody else have, I think that's what I had on the agenda. Does anybody else have anything else they wanted to bring up, discuss here while we've got our sort of free for all in the work session?
I do, Mike. I just wanted to bring okay. up one more time, my last chance to bring up my concerns about the limited access on the Hydro Road. I was thinking about that a lot lately, and I think the city should take a stronger stance on it. I think the city has more power than we are acknowledging in this. It could take months to years for the litigation to finally figure out who has, you know, whether or not there's a public easement or not. I believe there is, but until Bear Track owners believe there is, we have a big problem. Elders are being harassed. Hikers are being harassed. My friend who has a place at Ring Creek Road, his access out was blocked by a vehicle, by one of their vehicles. It's just not acceptable. I think the city should write a strongly worded letter saying that the Bear Track Inn owners are not being community minded. They are not being a helpful part of this community. And, you know, there could even be, this might not come from the city, maybe this would be better once I'm off the council, from outside, a petition from people around the community petitioning them to give that up, to just allow for access like it should be. And then the other option is they're on the GVA, and we fund the GVA, and we could actually, or GVA could kick them off of GVA for not being helpful members, community-minded members. And so I'm going to be off the council. I won't be able to help with that, but I'm happy to help from the outside. I think that, you know, just with all the issues with access that we have at the beach right now that are kind of in the city's department, this going on out the road, out Ring Creek Road, like, I think we can be a strong advocate for access there, for foot access and health of this community. And, you know, maybe there's something we can do to help address the Bear Track Inn owners' concerns about theft and whatever else, but we really need to take a strong stand on that. Thanks.
Well, let me give you a little bit of an update on this. You're probably aware that back in August, I wrote a 4-page letter to AP&T laying out a strong position that it's essentially what you're advocating. We do continue to believe that the easement is an easement that covers all aspects of the project, not just the power generation, but also the recreational aspects. And that's in line with what the FERC license says and requires. The fact that we've written that letter, and also another community member wrote to FERC directly and raised it with them, which was a step that we had sort of in our back pocket, if need be. That has elevated it with the discussion with AP&T. They have assigned Jason Custer as vice president to work through this thing. They have a lawyer contracted to advise them on it. They are fully aware of our position. As I understand it, the Department of the Interior is monitoring this as well. I think that something is going to happen now because the urgency has increased with the input from FERC. And so I am confident that Jason Custer will work through this issue thoughtfully They are fully aware of what the public's strong interest is in this, and they're aware of the requirements of the FERC license, which I believe are strongly in the public's favor. And I think that it's likely we'll get a resolution, but it's probably going to be later in the winter or so before it becomes evident. And I'd like to leave it to them to continue to work on that. In the meantime, those of us who use the Hydro Road are bound to assure that we are having zero impact on the properties as we pass up and down the road, the properties along and the operations on either side of the road. That's only the decent thing. We can't be trespassing off the road. We can't be shooting guns and doing obnoxious things on there, but not that I think any of our recreational users have done that. But our responsibility is to use the road with respect in accordance with the provisions of the road management plan and the public recreation and access plan that are part of the FERC permit. So respect on our side is important for the properties on either side, the operations. And I'll give AP&T more time to continue to get this resolved. And who knows, they may be facing some legal action to get it done. But that's kind of where it is. But thanks for your concern. I share it. Anybody else?
One more issue. I was wondering what the status of the EMS coordinator position is.
Kathy, do you want to report on that?
Sure. We received one application and we were have the paperwork drafted up for that to begin tomorrow, once signed. So they will start putting a plan together of what's going to be happening in terms of some of the upcoming trainings, how to bring in new members, how to try to expand the department volunteer base, and to get people more current on more trainings. That's the first part of it, and they will also be working with the medical director to figure out exactly a plan of trainings that are needed the most, that he feels are needed the most. So that's what's going on with that.
And I have an update on the beach chair. It's all been this convoluted journey, I guess, because I wasn't here for a variety of reasons when it was initially discussed. And I listened to the tape of the recording of the meeting. And in it, I know that, Shelley, you mentioned you had talked with someone at SAIL about the possibility of a donated chair. And so I followed up on that, and we have the donated chair, and it's sitting in here. And I'll bring it out to show you. But I do have to say, it comes with some issues, and it comes with some maintenance issues, and maintenance was one of the things that was the big deal we didn't want to have to deal with. And the maintenance issue is that one of the tires doesn't seem to keep air. And so I wrote to them and said, okay, so we got it, but can you tell me about the status of the tire? And they said, well, tires are supposed to not be pumped up real high, and they gave this explanation, but the two tires are very not the same. The one tire is like very, very flat. And so I'll bring the thing in here. It also doesn't come with footrests, which I think is a really important part of a beach wheelchair, is to have footrests on a chair. And so they sent it to us, they donated it to us, we paid a little bit of freight coming over, but now I think it's up to us to decide, is this the chair we want, or do we want to put some time and effort into making it feasible. But here it is.
I
Well, no, but I had problems even on the carpet. Sure.
Oh my God. Go. Any chance we can get the camera to pan that way? I don't know if there's a setting, but I'd be curious to. Would that I could be there to see this in person. Brilliant. Thank you. Oh, look at that.
So my point is that I think that this one will probably need to help with how to put it. Oh, I'm wondering if you put that. I'm wondering if you're on straight. Right, yeah. So this model is very different than the model that I was proposing. And so we have this, but it was my experience when I tried to push Larry in it across the room when we first got it, that it was like, oh, this is a little difficult. So I, you know, where do we go forward? I mean, I'm going to go back and propose that we go with one that is a little bit more, that's designed a little better. The cost of just the chair itself was $2,475. If we, you know, take out perhaps the other options, and I would suggest we go with one that is a little bit better engineered than this one. But if someone wants to see if they can get this one to work better, that's fine. But I think that it does come with some limitations. Right. I did, and they said no, it never had them, and that maybe we could find some generic ones that would work with it. And
here you go.
And so this is what it is. You see, that that's kind of what I'm like. My grandmother would say, "Don't look a gift horse in the mouth." But I don't want. Yeah, I mean. It just, yeah. And so her response was, well, but you know, the footrests weren't necessary because people didn't take people all that far down the beach. Well, maybe people didn't take people very far down the beach because it didn't work really functionally. And that having one that was more functional might be a better option.
So it was hard for me to see. Oh, I'll let Mike go here first.
Well, I was just going to say, let's take a look and see. Maybe there's a possibility of fabricating something for a footrest locally that might, you know, if it looks like something that's doable easily, then maybe we can still make good use of this one, even though we may decide to buy a better one. And we were also interested in, you know, a walker. And possibly even a stroller for the beach. The idea was that people should be able to get way down on the beach strand and go for quite a ways in this. And so it is a little disappointing that it doesn't have footrests. My guess is the tire thing we can fix, even if we have to send the wheel and tire over to Les Schwab or something. They can fix it, but. I'm sure we can come up, we can fix that. So let's continue to take a look at it and see what we can do with this, but also go back to considering the other ones that we looked at previously that looked pretty attractive. That sound okay?
Yeah, yes. And then the, you know, the thing that also becomes this issue we have to think about is the storage of them. And if we have one thing, it's a small building that's about, like I like to say, about the size of a doghouse that you could put one chair in. As I'm realizing, if we then add things, then we get this building bigger. And do we want that? And I guess I'm open for discussion of what, you know, people's ideas are, whether we go with, you know, a different wheelchair, or we fix this one, or we add a walker or a jogger. And then we really do need to deal with and grapple with the issue of where do we store it. And one thing stores a whole lot easier than a series of more. And I'm wondering if, you know, it's a mission creep by adding the jogger and adding the walker. And maybe we start with buying just one of these other, the debug, the wheelchair. We build something that is just big enough to store one item, which could go, I think, talking with Ben and talking with Larry, out by the dock where there's the, is it an electric box? As you're facing the water onto the left side, there's a an electric box there. And there's, then it's kind of by where there's the bench. And I think something fairly small could go there. We could draw a picture on it of the wheelchair so people would know what it was. And it would be really usable and accessible and just right there. The problem, if we start adding things, now we get a bigger structure, and then that becomes a whole lot of issues in and of itself. So, and you know, I'm thinking about this and trying to make it as easy as possible and as functional as possible. My suggestion, and I'm wanting feedback from people, is what they're thinking, but is that we purchase a reliable chair for the $2,475, and then we build a small little house thing for it that it just fits in and out of, and put it right there at the top of the dock. And it's very accessible. It's easy to get it. It's easy to put it back. And it would be much simpler than having a project that had several things involved. So I'm asking for people's feedback and what they think.
Yeah. Yeah, this is Mike. I like that idea. We'd have to get permission from DOT to put the shelter in that location. Unfortunately, that's right in there right away, and they tend not to let us do things in there right away. But we might be able to put it just enough out of it that it's okay. And it occurs to me that the one that you've got there in City Hall, if we don't use it at the beach, maybe it could live at the picnic shelter at the Salmon River Park, and would be available for use in the park, in and about the park. So, say somebody watching the kids on the swing or whatever. So we might be able to use that there.
My suggestion would be to try this one out on the beach sand. That beach sand is very soft. I walk it every day. And I think you're going to find out that it's just, I mean, you know, your feet sink in. I don't, and I don't know whether there's any possibility of when you're traveling, you know, finding some of these builders or contractors that make these things and testing them out. But because our strand, it's narrow, it's very soft, I think it's not feasible. And
so I think, though, the idea isn't just the beach sand necessarily, but also the trail, and then going out all through those meadows where it's fairly hardened, but you wouldn't be able to take a regular wheelchair. And so I think that if it doesn't, you know, work on the sand all the time, it still would have its benefits of allowing people to go on any of those places on the more hardened trails where they would, you know, because it's, if you've ever pushed somebody in a wheelchair, a little tiny bump is a big deal.
Yeah.
And so
I would suggest that you try it out. There's no hardened trails except for the one, you know, on the east beach side.
Well,
or the west beach side.
So so there's harder packed ground that and I don't know that this one is going, the one that we have here is going to work. I think that this one is like, doesn't live up to the expectation of the one that I'm looking at. And so, I mean, we could try this one, but you saw how hard it was to push it across the carpet. I was really disappointed when I used to Larry like sit down and in here I'll push you, and I went, it wasn't going anywhere. So but I mean, I think it's worthwhile if someone wants to take a look at it and maybe use it at the Salmon River Park, but I'm agreeing that it's going to be problematic on the beach.
Well, we can sure take it down there and give it a try, or, you know, just see what it does. But go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, I would say quick thoughts are that I like the idea of the project staying smaller in scope, and definitely would agree that we should at least give this a college try and take it down there and see how it goes before. I mean, I haven't had the chance to push it around, so maybe if I had done that, it would be my expectation would be different. But it seems like we ought to at least give it a shot, and maybe, you know, are the bearings sticking, or, you know, is there any kind of maintenance or lube or whatever we can do to make this work? And then I guess if we decide we wanted to buy something else, I would want to be reasonably confident that we would not have this kind of disappointment happen again if we had then just spent, you know, $2,500 on a chair to have it get here and go, ah, drat, this isn't going to work. So that would be my request, is if we decide, you know, this one's not going to work, let's buy a new one, that we have a way to feel confident that the new one's going to actually meet the expectation.
I'm not clear on where you guys suggested that you would put the little building if we had one. You said it was by the box, by the picnic table?
So at the top of the ramp from the, you know, the main dock, at the top of the dock. So as you're going out onto the dock to the left, there's a green electric box. So right in that area.
So how tall would this be? Because I can tell you right now, people are not going to want their view shed dealt with in that manner down there.
See, that's why I'm thinking, you take the chair and you build a roof over it. So you're going to be 4 feet high, 5 feet high at the most. Not even probably. I mean, how
why couldn't
tall is
they
that
put
chair?
It over, build a little roof over it, over by the vaulted toilets?
That's pretty far away from where people would be accessing it. But I mean, I think I'm open for people coming and we walk around and make a decision. But I think that, so I've had some discussion about this and whether we, then it gets, is it in the way of the pump truck, or is it, I think it would be a good idea to answer this question when we're down there and thinking about how is it really going to get used and accessed? My first thought was to be by the vault of toilets, but in talking with other people, the feedback I've gotten, well, that's far away from where the beach trail is, and would it get used, and would people know it was there? And, you know, Ben and Larry were suggesting, oh, maybe we'll put it more so it's more obvious, which then put it closer to the dock. I mean, there's lots of options, and I'm open for discussion of what people think. And maybe some, you know, one thing I think is that, like, taking the chair down there and moving it around might actually be a way to figure out where we would put it. But I agree, it should be low. It's like, that's where I'm thinking, you know, not to make it be a big, huge shed, but just to be, it's something where you open the door and it pushes in and it pulls out, and the shed is only 6 inches taller than the chair, so that you don't have a big view shed issue.
Yeah, the little shelter could be a skid, so we can move it around. If one place didn't seem to work out, we can move it. You know, if it was just a skid, either pick it up with a forklift, or it might be light enough that a couple of people could pick it up and move it without a forklift. Okay, well, I think we got some ideas there. Thanks for the update on that, Janine. Anything else that anybody else wants to bring up? I'm not
briefly
anything, so... Oh, go ahead, Brian.
Sorry, it took me a second to get to my unmute button. I don't want to talk in circles on this here, and I know we've already addressed it, but I didn't quite get a chance to interject, so I do want to echo Tanya's sentiment on the issue out at the end of the road. And I think if we don't see any action on that from AP&T say by, I don't know, March come around thereabouts, I would be really interested in drafting and supporting, whether that's a resolution or something to, I see a mic being passed.
I like the idea of sooner than March, right off the cuff, but that was kind of generous.
It's definitely, I mean, I guess, you know, trying to strike a balance between giving them time to work through the process, but also being really clear that, that's not something that we're going to, you know, take lying down in this community. So I think, you know, trying to thread the needle of obviously not aggravating the situation more, but making it clear where we stand. And I think even if APNT through our internal communications is already well aware of how we feel, I think that it can't hurt to make our feelings explicitly public. So
fair take, Brian.
That's all though.
And so I'm curious as to what involvement we've had or is there from the national park. I mean, I think a reasonable person would think that that access is public access because the National Park Service has put up a big sign with a map and a painted map, and it's there's a brochure you pick up that welcomes you to walking on there, and so it seems that at some point the National Park Service was, you know, had the authority to put that sign up and show you where the road was and where the parking areas are. And it basically, you know, there's a whole little brochure that's there at that map. And so I think a reasonable person who would go up there and sees that there's this map that shows you where you can go, and there's a little handout trail guide you can pick up, that you would expect the person would think that it was, they were, you know, it was something that was public property, I guess, or accessible.
Yeah, you might be surprised to how. Do you mind if I take this, Mike? Do you mind?
Go ahead.
You might be surprised to find that that map actually is put out there by AP&T as part of their contract. So that's not put up by the Park Service. That's something that AP&T has put out there, I guess, because Gustavus Electric Company at some point. But that's explicit in their contract with FERC that they have to have that information. But I think your logic still stands, that it's pretty clear the spirit of all of that was to make it public access. That's why we put out that's why, you know, maps and everything in a brochure that's even available on the AP&T website. So yeah, the logic stands, but it's even, I won't say egregious, but, you know, more funny that, you know, that's the power company putting all that information out there.
Yeah, that's to add on to that, that's all, those items are all covered in the public recreation and access plan for the Falls Creek Hydro Project. So they're required items, and they did they're actually back in 2016 was when AP&T took over ownership of the operation from Gustavus Electric Company, they did a review on the performance of the electric company to date with regard to the requirements of the plan. And they identified a few shortcomings and took and resolved some of them in there, you know, since then. So they, that's all part of their FERC license requirement. The Park Service and Department of the Interior, though, is aware of the conflict, and the Department of Interior Solicitor's Office is, as I understand it, is monitoring the situation or giving it some thought. Now, whether anything will come out of that, I don't know, but of course the park has plans to develop trails and other recreational opportunities in, you know, that would be reached from the Falls Creek area. So they clearly have a stake in it, even though they're not party to the easements.
Am I unmuted? Can you hear me?
Oh yeah. That's Jim Mack. Yes, we can hear you. I didn't know you were here.
Yeah, I've been. I'm the person who contacted FERC, and I'll send Liza a copy of the letter they sent, and she should distribute it to the council members, and they can see. But FERC gave AP&T 30 days to respond to their questions, and so things are going to happen sooner rather than later. AP&T has said for months that they've been diligently working on this, when actually they've done nothing, but this got their attention.
Certainly did. Okay. So we'll continue to let you know what.
Sorry, I've been trying to get a word in here. Just back to the Park Service, I did talk to the outdoor recreation planner, and I got the idea that yes, the park is concerned, but not going, but leaving it to AP&T and FERC to work it out. And that is exactly my concern, is that it doesn't seem like there's been any forward momentum from them. I hope that this letter from FERC will get the ball rolling. But in the meantime, I think people are looking to the city to do something here. And at least, if nothing else, information, like sending out, well, who do you even talk to? Is it AP&T? Is it FERC? And yeah, I think that we should be at in front of this. And I know Jim has been working on it, and Mike too, but I just think we should really come out with a strong voice that this is goes against our vision statement to restrict access to recreational use, and it's affecting all these other people, and we don't approve of it. I think that would be a good start for us, and it would let the community know that we're doing something. That's it. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Brian? You're applauding. Okay.
Yeah, I was just applauding via Zoom.
Thanks. Okay. Okay. Have we covered everything we need to do then? If so, thank you all for your participation, and Liesl for getting this together for us. We'll be posting our agenda for next Monday's general meeting on Wednesday, I guess, so, or late Wednesday or Thursday morning, whatever. And we'll see you all next week.
Actually, we'll see you Friday night at 6 p.m. for our Canvas meeting.
Oh, yes. That's right. Thanks for mentioning that. And we need everybody who can possibly be there in the room. I hope that I'll be totally negative on my COVID test by then. But we do need people because we need, really helps to have at least 6 council members there to canvass the votes the way that the structure of the county is. So everybody that can be there, please be. Okay. With that, I guess we'll adjourn our work session, and thank you all for participating tonight. Good evening.